Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels in for Michael Krasny. Coming soon on a public television station near you, a four-part, four-hour documentary series on China. Its promoters say it's as comprehensive as can be. They had unfettered, well, almost unfettered access to most things Chinese. We'll talk with the producer of the series about how he did his work, how he gained access, and what he found when he spent more than a year in China. The series is called China from the Inside, and you can join us to talk about it right after this. Welcome to Forum from KQED-FM. I'm Spencer Michaels in for Michael Krasny. With 1.3 billion people, China is the world's biggest and one could argue potentially the world's most important nation. But it's been billed pretty much a closed society, hard to fathom, hard to gain access to, especially for Western journalists and filmmakers. Excuse me. Over the last 4 years, a filmmaker from Britain, Jonathan Lewis, has been working inside China on a major series about to be aired on American public television and on Granada in England. The series, 4 one-hour programs, is called China from the Inside, and it deals with the Communist Party and how it works, the women of China and their role in a changing society, environment, polluted and dangerous, and freedom and justice, including a look at religion and the Falun Gong. With us to talk about his film and to give us the inside story is Jonathan Lewis, who his press release modestly bills as the writer, narrator, producer, and director of China from the Inside. All purpose. You did the whole thing, Jonathan.
I had nobody to play bridge with.
Incidentally, the film airs on Channel 9, KQED, Wednesday at 9 and at 10, and then the following Wednesday at 9 and at 10, so it's 4 hours long. Well, let's talk about getting into China and going to the Chinese and saying, I want to make a film and I want to be honest. What did they say? Oh, sure, come right over.
I don't think they did. This was, I mean, we spent 2 years making the film, but it probably took close to 3 years to get the permissions tied up. And I suppose there was a key decision, which was to be honest with them. You know, the temptation, I suppose, if you're dealing with a regime that's authoritarian at best and totalitarian at worst, is you write one bunch of treatments to sell the idea to KQED in this case, to PBS, to the BBC in Granada. And that's not exactly the document that you send to the Chinese, because you don't want to be so open about what it is you want to do. But I took rather a contrary view of it and said, let's be honest with them. That way, they'll either say no, in which case, you know, end of story, or they will say yes, in which case we, in a sense, have got some kind of permission to be awkward, to be slightly difficult, to ask difficult questions, to ask to go to difficult places like prisons and labor camps and party meetings.
Because you don't want them to say no. I mean, if they say no, end of story, then you got to go out and pitch something else.
I that's right. But we were desperate to make the series about China. And in a sense, the option, in a way, if you look at it, is to say, well, we could do it secretly. You know, but we didn't want to do it secretly. I didn't want to scurry around the place because I also wanted to be able to ask officials questions. And what was quite interesting about this, Spencer, was that when we went into a situation, even away from big cities, talking to ordinary people, they were reassured by our official permission into talking. In other words, it was safer for them to talk to us because we were there officially than it might have been if we'd, you know, gone in pretending we were doing something about, you know, the beautiful birds of Sichuan or something.
But if you had a minder with you, and in fact you wrote yourself that you had minders, dozens of minders, people who were with you all the time from the government, somebody standing over here telling you about whether they're going to be displaced from their home because of the Three Gorges Dam, is this person going to say, yeah, it's terrible, my family was displaced, I hate it, the government is really loused up, you know?
I can only say to you, I agree. When I hear you saying that, I think, yes, this man is right, you know, this is a crazy idea, but actually it worked. I can only put this down, well, I can put this down to a number of different things. In other words, the short answer to your question is, we did have minders, and people did shoot their mouths off. And I think this is quite an interesting thing, because what it suggests to me is firstly that that China is in some ways a freer society internally than perhaps we give it credit for. In other words, people who are passionate and who want to shoot their mouths off do so. If they are particularly emotionally upset or worked up or aggrieved enough to, and they'll take their chances if there's an official standing by, because the officials can't arrest everybody, you know, 1.3 billion
people. But if you ask the folks from Falun Gong about this, they'll say they'll throw you in jail, they'll harvest your body parts.
Yeah, that's right. I think that there are people who've paid the penalty incredibly for being out of line. And one of the things we were most concerned with was not putting people who spoke to us in a difficult position of not actually walking away from a situation where somebody had said, I've been moved because of the Three Gorges Dam and I'm miserable about it. We go around the corner, get into our bus, go off to our hotel, have dinner. This person winds up in the slammer. This was something we were very concerned about. And that's another reason why working officially was oddly easier, because once the Minister of Information has said it's okay to stop people on the street and talk to them, it becomes that much more difficult for people to take measures against them. The other thing is, there's no question but that there were some people who said some things that we didn't use. We thought that they'd gone too close to the wind.
For example?
If I was to tell you that, there'd be no point in me carrying it out of my movie.
But, I mean, what kinds of things are you talking about?
I'm talking about the area where people are excessively critical. You know, where their grievances with the state are sufficiently sort of deep that they say things that they might not have said if they'd waited 24 hours, and then, you know what I mean, when you write the letter of complaint but you don't post it immediately.
But as a journalist,
yeah.
I mean, if that were to happen to me, I would find a way to work that into the story, even though I might not embarrass the person who said it and get him hurt later. But you would get the tone into the story. Did you try to do that?
I certainly did. I couldn't agree with you more. That's exactly what we did. To find ways of absorbing some of that heat, but nevertheless transmitting it to the audience, making sure that they know that these things are very passionately held views about religion, about the right to live in a society that is not polluted, all these kinds of issues, the rights of women. So I don't think we in any way have failed to deliver the powerful messages that the people of China want airing.
I want to talk specifically about some of the subjects that you talk about and talk about China. But before that, I want to just a few nuts and bolts that are interesting to me. KQED's name, for example, is on the masthead and the publicity for this project. What role does a local station like KQED have in producing? You're from England and your group is with Granada, I guess. What did the local station do?
You have to block your ears because you may blush, because I'm full of admiration for KQED. KQED, it may look like a local station to you, but to me it doesn't seem like a local station. To me it was the springboard for public television looking west out of the United States. They were people who responded immediately to, the station was, responded immediately to the idea that we should do something on China, that we should look at China from the inside. So KQED were in on this project from the very, very beginning as our partners.
And they helped facilitate it.
They helped facilitate it. They provided links into the local community, funding, advice. Board members of KQED were generous with their time. People who traveled to and fro in China. Meetings were arranged. Dinners were arranged. I listened to people. I met people. I talked to people. And they fed back to me also, which is a very interesting two-way street, the kinds of requirements that they would have for a television series like this in outreach terms, in getting out to their own communities. Could we generate material that could be used to help teach and explain and explore with school kids, with educators?
Internet, so forth.
All this.
All right, let me ask you another nuts and bolts question. How much does it cost to make a documentary like this?
It costs around somewhere over $4 million.
Wow, $4 million. And you've got 4 1-hour shows. Each hour is worth $1 million.
It's about that, yes.
Is that a good way to spend your money?
Yes, I think it is a good way to spend your money. I think you get very, very, very few chances to get into a country as complex and as comparatively closed on these serious issues. You can get into China easily, if you want to look at terracotta warriors, or you're doing athletic training for the 2008 Olympics, or you want to look at some of the magnificent buildings that they're putting up.
Or you want to buy sneakers.
You want to buy sneakers, or you want to look at how wonderfully developed Shanghai is. But it's really, really, I think, I've been told that this is absolutely the first time that anybody has been able to go in there openly and discuss freedom, justice, Falun Gong, unrest, religion, the rights of women, the rights of people not to be polluted, elections, in the detail in which we do it. So I think $1 million for that, you know, has to be seen as a long-term investment in terms of letting people know, and also opening the doors, I hope, for other people to go in and ask more searching questions or broader questions along these lines.
So tell me what you found out that you didn't expect to find out. I mean, you've obviously did research ahead of time. You know the political structure in China. You know that the area is polluted. You know the Yangtze River story. I mean, those are all available in the press. You can read about that. What did you find out that you didn't know?
One of the things I think we found out most of all was that the Chinese people themselves have an acutely sharp perception of their own situation. The idea that you walk in from the outside because you've read the New York Times or you've seen a good segment on a television show about their problems and that you'll know more about their problems than they do, or their successes, you can just kiss goodbye to the minute you set foot there. They know it. They live it. They breathe that air. They know what's going on in their communities, and they know the challenges that they face, and they know many of the ways in which they can get solutions organized, because this is their country. It would be like somebody from the other side of the world coming in and telling you what to do in your street or in your neighborhood or in your PTA. The chances are you know more about it than they do. So we were surprised by their breadth of their knowledge and also their commitment to the country. Now, you know, this is another interesting thing. There is a sort of tendency to feel that, and for some of the Chinese authorities to feel that if somebody criticizes China, they're a traitor, they're treasonous, there's something wrong here, they shouldn't do it. But actually the people that did have suggestions as to how to improve the country were passionately devoted to their country. They saw the idea of improvement being entirely compatible with patriotism.
As opposed to what? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
As opposed to being a subversive who wants to bring the place down and cause damage and distress.
Did you find subversives who wanted to bring the place down?
No, I didn't. I found people who were deeply critical in some cases of the situation, but wanted to work with the situation, not against it.
And what were the parts, what did people want to change? What were the complaints that they wanted to work on?
There are a big range of them. I think some of them wanted...
Let's talk, you sort of organize it into four subjects because of the documentary, but let's talk about politics. What do they want to change?
I think that they are feeling their way to being able to make decisions about who looks after them, about who's running the village, who's running the town. You could leap out here, Spencer, and say, do they want democracy? And I would have to say I can't answer that question because I don't know that they see it as democracy. They may see it more as we want a good village leader. We want somebody who really will look after our interests, who won't be corrupt, because there are very serious problems of corruption, as you know, from top to bottom in the country, at the highest levels of government and officialdom, and also in villages where somebody, for instance, might want to be paid off in order to give permission for you to extend your fence or to graze your cattle over there. They want that to stop. Ordinary people told us that. They told us that on film. You'll see it in the program, saying we don't want corrupt leaders. We want people who are honest and who are going to do good for us.
My guess is that that's the government line as well from the top. They don't want village leaders to be corrupt. But what about corruption and dictatorship from the very top? I mean, you could see what was going on in the villages because you went to the village. But the top of Chinese politics is a pretty closed place from what I've read.
Except that they are arresting people. They are putting people in jail. We go into a jail to talk to somebody who was an accountant inside a big, big firm who was found guilty of corruption. We talk to a prosecutor who specializes in corruption cases. And she says that the party has said, which is absolutely the case, that if they don't solve corruption, it'll be the death of the party. And, serious stuff.
And they're talking all levels, not just...
No, all levels. They're talking all levels. Now it's very difficult cleaning out Augean stables, and I don't think it can be done overnight. But there are a lot of good people over there who are acutely aware that to be fair and honest to people and to give people an even break, you can't have corrupt leadership. You can't have corrupt people, whether it's down in the village or whether it's up in the city.
We're talking with Jonathan Lewis, who is the producer and director and narrator and writer of China from the Inside, a documentary series that will be on KQED Wednesday at 9 and at 10, and then the following Wednesday at 9 and 10, and also all over the country on whatever PBS station you watch. Associated Press story yesterday, China must meet its international human rights obligations, French presidential candidate Ms. Royale said on a trip to China, where she hopes to bolster her foreign policy credentials. China's record on human rights has been controversial. Nancy Pelosi has been crowing about it for years and years. What did you find in terms of human rights?
I think there is a growing pressure inside China for social justice. That can in places be religious freedom. The feeling that you want to be able to worship, for instance, in a church that doesn't have the Communist Party sitting on top of it. What did one man say to me? Nobody between me and my God. Didn't want the party between him and his God. If he wants to kneel down and pray, he doesn't want to feel that there's a party official above him. You know that the Catholic Church in China is not the Roman Catholic Church because it doesn't answer to Rome. It answers essentially to the party.
But there is a Catholic Church in China.
There certainly is a Catholic Church. And there certainly are underground churches, illegal churches, some of which get into trouble and some of which don't. So there is a wide range of feelings social justice, the ability to live in a place where your job is not going to be taken away from you by somebody, for instance, polluting your fish farm, a factory that you have no claim against. So people who are moved off their land, people who have suffered from air pollution or from water pollution, have very little channel in China as of now to make their representations felt, to get things changed. So there is a growing pressure, it seems to me, on the Chinese authorities to find ways of responding to, of listening to people's problems and trying to solve them.
But people's problems are different than throwing folks in jail, if torture exists, of prison camp labor, many human rights abuses that get talked about all the time. Did you talk to officials about that, or did you see any of it?
Yes, we went into a labor camp. We see women working in fields who are working there, who are in prison for up to 4 years without trial. They are simply sent there by their local police station. You will see in the fourth episode riot, insurrection, cruel actions by thugs hired by local businesses, local corrupt and evil businesses. You will see this discussed, and you will see these pictures on the television. The Chinese authorities want stability, and stability can be got by crushing people, but it can also be got by listening to people. And I think you'll find different people inside the Chinese officialdom. It's wrong to see it, I think, as a monolithic entity. You'll find bad people who want to crush, who want to put people in jail, who don't want people to speak. But there'll also be officials, high government officials and local people who actually have a slightly different view of it. And there's an interesting kind of battle, if you like, going on as to how to deal with these problems. It's not a monolithic black and white situation.
How did you get into a prison camp, a work camp for prison?
We spent maybe a year trying to get that kind of material. In other words, putting in the requests and arguing and talking and begging and pleading and shouting and doing all sorts of things to get into a number of places, including not just into a labor camp, but also into law courts, seeing the state of justice. Now, you know, the state of justice in China is an extremely interesting thing because the judges are answerable to the party still. If there's a very important decision that has to be taken by a judge, that judge will almost certainly still be told what to decide by the local party. So an independent judiciary, a free and independent judiciary, is crucial to social justice in China. And there are people who are working away bravely at that as well.
And what happens to them? They're getting away with it?
They get away with it, and then sometimes they'll have a problem, and sometimes they don't have a problem, and sometimes somebody can be put under house arrest or told to shut up, and sometimes somebody will actually make some headway. And I think you'll see in the series, in every single episode, people who are, some of them academics, some of them are activists, some of them are campaigners. These are people who've stuck their head above the parapet in China. And sometimes they get it hit slightly, and sometimes they get it sort of chopped off, and sometimes they put the head back on again and pop it up over the parapet again. And they are slowly, I think, changing the way in which the Chinese themselves are thinking about their own country and realizing that these things may not be threats in the end to stability. They may actually guarantee survival and stability.
So you think the direction is going more toward negotiating and talking and taking it a little easier? You think there's an improving human rights record? That seems to be what you're saying.
I don't think I can judge whether there's an improving human rights record. I've got two answers to that. One is that actually what people have told me is that they feel, I'm talking about people inside China, they feel things are tightening up, and they relate it to the Olympics. They feel that the authorities are worried that people would show up at the Olympics in 2008 and be greeted by the spectacle of people who are unhappy, who are distressed,
cracking down, not
journalists
allowing,
getting sat on at the moment. Journalists being told that
Chinese journalists
being told they can't cover breaking stories without getting prior permission. So I'm not at all sitting here to tell you this is an optimistic situation in which I think everything's getting better. But what I do see is the positive signs of intelligent and committed people at every level, and that does mean also down in the village level and in the rural areas and the towns and the cities, who have a vision of how things ought to be and are fighting to try and achieve it. It's not as if it's a hopeless situation and nobody's trying and everyone's beaten down.
I know you talked to some high-up officials because I saw interviews with them. What do they say when you bring up this human rights record?
Well, it is really quite difficult to discuss human rights with very senior Chinese figures. It's quite difficult to discuss human rights with any Chinese people without putting them in a position in which it's almost impossible for them to say anything that we could use, that would be coherent enough to use. What we did find, for instance, on the subject of the environment, say, is that the Deputy Minister of the Environment, Pan Yue, is extremely critical in the interview that you'll see on the third program in the series. The government minister in charge of information, the Minister of Information, is quite outspoken about the need to solve the problems of rural unrest. These people did not duck these questions. They may not have had a solution to it, but they didn't duck them.
So, in general, was this a satisfying experience? You think you got more answers than you got questions?
I think it was very frustrating for us. I think we had big arguments. But I think it was as if you could see that there was a way forward, whether it was going to get taken, but there were people working for ways forward. And that has got to be a sort of optimistic thing.
We're talking with Jonathan Lewis, who is the director of China from the Inside, a four-part series on PBS starting this week on Wednesday. And we will continue with this in a few minutes with your phone calls. The number here is 866-733-6786, or you can send us an email at forum@kqed.org. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum from KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, and for Michael Krasny, we're talking with Jonathan Lewis, who is the director and producer of China from the Inside, a documentary, four documentaries about China, going to be on public television this week, Wednesday on KQED at 9 and 10, and then a week from Wednesday, also at 9 and 10. Excuse me. Incidentally, Jonathan Lewis is going to be at Berkeley tonight at 7 o'clock at the Pacific Film Archive for a forum on China. If you want to join this conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. We can talk anything you want about China, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Well, Jonathan Lewis, let's talk a little bit about the environment in China. The people I know who've gone to China and come back, many of them have come back sick because it's been so smoggy. It's a difficult environment. Did you find that?
I saw some pollution on a scale I'd never seen anywhere else in the world. There, the deputy minister of the environment says in the film that there are that China has in the top 10 most polluted cities in the world, China has 5 of them. Some people say that there are 15 out of the top 20. I have to say that when you're breathing it, it doesn't matter whether it's slightly more polluted than some city on the other side of the world. It's just bad. And people are dying, 400,000, I think the figure is, annually from heart and lung disease related to air pollution. There's a river that we have film of in episode 3 where 50,000 people have cancer along this comparatively small river. Oof. Because they're dumping all sorts of things, including arsenic and cyanide, into that river. The situation is extremely bleak, and it isn't just inside China, because the water that comes from China is used or passes by the homes of around a third of the world's population, because it flows down through India, it flows into Vietnam, the Mekong, the Brahmaputra. So people who get their water from China might have an expectation that it's clean, but unfortunately it isn't always clean. Their pollution from their factory chimneys is liable to land in Canada and here. You know, we're in a connected world in which air currents and water currents mean that messing it up over there means messing it up over here.
So I'll give you a half of a compliment, partly a criticism. The pictures in your documentary are spectacular. They are beautiful. You see animals in the field and peasants and people, and it's clear as a bell. It's lovely looking. Now, I haven't looked at the Shifting Nature, the episode 3 about pollution, but can you see the pollution? Is it obvious?
It's a great question. You can see the pollution. When we were doing the technical end processes, you know, there's a situation where you could take the film to the colorist, the person who sort of makes sure that everybody's face looks the color it ought to be, and their eyes are whatever it is, and the sky's blue, and all the rest of it, the grass is green. And he looked at these pictures and he said, "What do you want me to do here?" he said. And I said, "You just leave it exactly as it is." He said, "You want me to clean it up?" Because they've got some clever gizmos that will mean that they can press this button and suddenly the smog level's gone off a bit, you know?
I said, the famous smog filter.
Yes, the smog filter. And I said, "Mike, please leave these pictures as they are." He said, "I've never been asked to do that before. People always come in here wanting it cleaned up, you know?" Hmm. And I said, "I don't want it cleaned up. I don't want it any worse. I just want it so that at home you'll be able to see what it's actually like."
The answer developing nations usually give when you confront them with environmental problems that China has, for example, is that, yes, we are a developing nation. We don't have the resources and the money right now. It's more important we develop our economy than worry about the environment. When we get as rich as you are, then we'll worry about the environment. Is that the answer you heard?
Yeah. That's absolutely right. I think the people come out with that. They say, "Listen, you guys, you've already done your polluting, and now you know, and don't come to us." And who signed in for Kyoto and all these kinds of difficult things are said about how much pollution comes out of this country and my own country. I am really not sure that these are good answers. I tend to the view that if other people have gone through some kind of hell, then it's a good idea if other people listen to how you deal with that problem. You don't just say, "Well, okay, now we're going to do the same thing, and so please don't talk to us about it." I think there is a very, very good argument for saying that if you know people are getting hurt by pollution, if rivers are dying, rivers are black, you'll see in the film black rivers, rivers that kill people, If that's happening, that cannot be justified by development. That can't be a price that we should be prepared to pay. The Chinese should be prepared to pay.
Did you get any feeling that there was a nationwide concern about the environment, especially from the top, or is it just, well, we've got to accept this for the next millennium?
I think there's real tension in China over this issue. I think there are people who are very strongly committed to the idea of a clean environment and good public health. In the film, you'll see the Deputy Minister of the Environment, Pan Yue, who is a brave and outspoken and committed politician. If you can call a man who's not elected a politician, I think in some ways he is a politician. And he's a brave politician, and he wants the country to be cleaner. He doesn't want his people dying. He wants a balance made between development, and he takes the view that if development actually rides roughshod over people's health and people's lives, then it's only going to bite them in the back.
So what's he doing about it?
He's trying to shut down enterprises. He's trying to get the right to shut down enterprises. But it's interesting. He tells us in the film that he doesn't really have the power to shut down a bad power station, because that is like trying to put a brake on China, on her development, on her ability to earn foreign currency.
We actually have a call about the environment from Val in San Francisco. Hi, Val, you're on Forum.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. Very interesting show. I recently watched the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and in that movie they talk about automobile emissions rather extensively, and they say that China is actually far ahead of the United States when it comes to automobile emission standards. And I was wondering if the speaker had anything to say about that, whether he had run into anything regarding that.
Thank you.
Val, I'm not going to be able to help you much on this one. It was one of those topics, you know, when you've only got an hour to do, the environment, there are going to be some things that you don't do, and you know that there are important things that you're leaving out. I can only say that automobile use in China seems to be soaring. That when I first went to China, I saw a lot more bicycles. You know, you'd go along streets, there'd be bicycles and a few motorbikes or three-wheelers and things, and very few cars, and that seems to have switched around. And I'm told that the pollution coming from those cars is really quite high, and furthermore that the motor car usage and the take-up of motor cars in China is just soaring. Of course, the Chinese use this counter-argument, you know, don't let America tell us we shouldn't be having cars all over the place. these are very difficult arguments. 1.3 billion people, and they want to get around, and they don't want to be on a bicycle anymore.
Does the United States bear, or Europe, for example, bear any responsibility for this with all the manufacturing that's going on in China for the Western market? Can the West influence this situation?
Yeah, I think so, and I think in a way it ties in with what Val's saying, which is, you know, that they want our business because they want to develop. You know, they want to have a car. I mean, let's put it in simple terms. If you are living in a city and you go and working in a factory, and that factory is making things for Walmart or for Nike or for any of the Western companies, then they are entitled, if they work hard and save their money, to buy a car. Now, already then you can see a cycle there of dependency and interdependency, which can have big effects on changing nature of society, but it can also affect the environment.
All right, let's take a call from Conrad in San Francisco. Hello, Conrad, you're on Forum.
Yes, hi. You know, America telling China what to do. I've always been in favor of Nancy Pelosi's strong stance against China, as a lot of Chinese in America are. But I've, you know, 4,000 years of history or thousands of years of history have told us that, you know, we're going to change as we need to change. And I'm actually optimistic listening to the speaker. Now, he's been cautious, but I'm actually optimistic that this development is moving the social change. And I think that that's a better mover of change than, say, a strong-arm tactic from a foreign country. And over I hear on the program today that those who tell the Chinese what to do will get thrown back in their faces saying, all right, who are you to tell me what to do? Okay, look at you guys. You've done your polluting. You're the car culture of the world. You know, who are you to tell us how to change? You know,
okay,
or when to
interesting
change?
Point. You want to talk about
that? I think there's a lot of very good sense there. I think it's extremely difficult for people to go to the Chinese and tell them how to do that, how to run their lives. I think we have to look... we have to look our own past with China in the eye. Britain has a very, very grim past in China with the Opium Wars. People have long memories. They know that there have been a lot of exploitation of Chinese people in the past by Westerners, and that we, you know, our houses are not in order. Corruption and pollution are not confined to Asia. We have them in our own countries. So when we talk to China, it's possible that we would do better to listen rather than talk, and to share rather than preach.
China, of course, considers itself the Middle Kingdom, meaning we know what to do. You don't have to tell us what to do. It's interesting you brought up the Opium Wars, because that was the very first thing that was brought up to you when you started negotiations on being able to go to China. Tell us that.
That's absolutely right. I went to China with Deanne Hamilton of KQED and Dennis Kostick, who helped arrange the ideas and the finance for this series. And we went in to see the Minister of Information, and it was a great big formal room with lots of cups of tea and men in suits and this sort of thing. And then the minister came in, a very tall and imposing man. And after all, we wanted a lot from this guy, so we were suitably polite and deferential. And I had my suit on, which is not a usual event. And he sat down and he started to talk. And he didn't ask me what sort of a time I was having in China. And he didn't want to talk about the series. What he wanted to tell me was that Britain had run the Opium Wars, and that this was a very bad thing. And I said to him that I gave him my country's unreserved apology. And he roared with laughter because he knew that I didn't have the right to do that. I didn't have the right to apologize. And it was a pretty meaningless thing. But it taught me this lesson, which is that you can't pitch up there and come the big guy. You have to find ways of listening and talking and, as I say, sharing and working with the grain and seeing things from their point of view, which is, I think, what we would expect other people to do for us.
We're talking with Jonathan Lewis, who's the producer and director of China from the Inside, a series that's going on PBS starting this Wednesday on KQED at 9 and 10 o'clock. Here's a question that I wanted to ask you, and Graham in San Francisco sends us an email. He says, great program. Please ask your guests how often requests for bribes were made, whether any were given, and how difficult it was to stay principled.
I think that is a great question. I wish he hadn't asked it, but I think it's a great question.
If he hadn't, I would.
We were asked for... I suppose we have to work out what bribes mean. I mean,
now
money...
we're going to find out what you spent the $4 million for. Huh?
Gosh, nobody's listening to this program, are they?
I hope not.
What's it worth your while, Spencer, just to change the subject or play some music?
No, I've been on foreign trips, and once in a while somebody asked for something. What did you get asked?
We certainly did, and it was a very interesting. It was a very interesting situation. We got asked for money to pay for the people who accompanied us, to pay for the facilities that we received from the central government, and. My tactic with that was to recognize, firstly, that they did have genuine expenses. These people were moving around. We were using up personnel's time. But to pay for it as close to what I guessed was cost as possible. So we did have big arguments about beating people down on price. I hope the finance guys from KQED are listening to this. We got the very best deal, guys, that we could possibly get. And sometimes we flatly refused. For instance, we would not pay for interviews. People said, "Well, I'll talk to you, but you'll have to pay me." And we wouldn't do that because I think that really does clutter up the situation.
Parenthetically, I have to tell you, I was in England once and I wanted to interview a barrister with a wig on. And he said, in order to interview me, you'll have to pay me. Yeah. So it doesn't just happen in China.
I think it's a disgraceful practice. Then there were situations where a place would want money. Now, the most serious situation that we ran into was in Tibet, where they insist upon being paid money for access.
They meaning Tibetans or Chinese who've moved to Tibet? Or both?
I mean the authorities.
The authorities.
And I think it puts people in a very difficult situation. If you don't pay, you don't get in. If you don't get in, then you can't bring the story back. So we paid, but we fought hard to pay as little as possible. But I thought it was worth doing.
Chuck in San Francisco has been waiting patiently. Go ahead, Chuck. You're on forum.
Thank you very much. Very interesting show. I was hoping to get some insight into the causes of the problems in the rural areas. Is it a sort of a zero sum where you can't industrialize without... dismantling an agrarian system, economy, and way of life? Is it because of free trade agreements and agricultural imports, or the need to get cheap labor by moving people off the land, or ideological, or why? What's the cause of those problems?
This is a big issue. We do look at it in the series. Let me point you particularly towards the fourth episode, where we look at these problems. But you'll see it also in the second episode, where people leave the land of their own volition. Now, I didn't get any sense of people being sort of bussed off the land. I know there are places where they say that this sort of thing happens, where they commandeer labor for certain projects. But what I saw in person was economics driving people off the land. So people, migrant workers, it is, I think, the largest migration in world history. Some people put it as 120 million, it may be even more, move off the land. And they go and work in cities. They go and work. They stitch jeans. They make computers. They do all kinds of work in factories.
One of the best pictures in the documentary that I liked was the train station. At the time when these workers you're talking about were going home for the 2 weeks at Christmas or whatever.
New Year.
Go back to. And the scenes are amazing. People carrying all these bundles and jumping onto these trains and trying to get home to see their families in the rural areas for the 2 weeks that they have. The pictures are great.
Yeah, and I suppose the question is, I mean, you know, the point the question is making is, you know, are we driving that in any way? You know, what is that to do with? And the answer is, I'm afraid that we are probably driving that. We want our computers, or we want our whatever.
We, the global economy.
We, the global economy, want our bits and pieces. So the demand that we make is fueling the construction of factories, and that has a demand for labor. Now, one of the interesting things that's happening is there are sweatshops. You know, there are people who are earning very little money and who are having to work very terrible hours. And what we're starting to see is, in some places, they're finding it difficult to get labor because the workers show up for work. They have to work, in some cases, 24 hours a day. We interview somebody who says that she is not allowed to speak from 8 minutes past six in the morning to 8 minutes past six in the evening. 12 hours, she's not allowed to speak.
Is that a sweatshop? Is that what you consider
a sweatshop?
Yeah,
she's working in a sweatshop. And
By implication, are you saying that the other people we saw running for that train to get home are not working in sweatshops?
I think some of them are and some of them aren't. I think some of them are working on building sites and may not have been paid for 6 months. I think there will be people there whose lives have been changed by those people running for trains who are getting paid. Whose lives have been changed and who are putting their kids through college on the back of this work. Don't let's talk about it in black and white terms. You will see every single shade of grey. You know, people who are having a good time, people having a bad time, people who have time in the middle. And what is interesting is to start to realise that there are people who are saying, actually, we don't want to be exploited like that. We're going to vote with our feet. The great thing that workers can do, you know, not going to show up for work, going to go somewhere else.
And I guess the greater the economy becomes in China, the more chance they have to do that. If there's ever a labor shortage, hard to believe with 1.3 billion people, but if there ever is a labor shortage, then these people are going to have some say in what the conditions are, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that we're starting to see, we're not starting to see it, we're in the middle of it, is big shifts in society, in the movement of people, means that there are some places where there are no women in certain towns. The one-child policy has got something a great deal to do with this. But there is also a fact that some industries employ more women than men, and you'll go to some towns where 80% of the women, 80% of the workforce are women. I remember talking to one woman who, and I said, are you going to go home and tell your friends, your girlfriends who are at school with you, that it's, she was having a good time in the city working in a factory. And I said, you're going to go and bring the good news about working in the factory back home to your village. She said, what would be the point? All the girls have left.
Amazing. Let me give out a phone number one more time, 866-733-6786, if you want to join our discussion. 866-733-6786. We have a couple of several email questions. Here's a good one. We're talking to Jonathan Lewis, by the way, the director of China from the Inside documentary series on PBS. Could you comment on the state of public health infrastructure in China? Is the restaurant food clean and safe to eat? She has some other questions, but let's stick with those.
Sounds like she's planning a trip.
Well, I wondered. Probably a lot of people are thinking about that, though. Did you eat in restaurants?
Ate all over the place. Ate in smart restaurants, ate in stalls by the side of the road, ate in people's houses. I think it's a good idea to be careful, but I don't think it's an idea to panic. I think if you're talking about it as a traveler, as a visitor to the country, I think you can have a great time and you can have some great food. I think that there'll be some cuisines that maybe are a bit spicy, and that can have an effect on people's stomachs. I always take a good set of medicines in a little bag when I'm with my crew. Were we sick on the crew? We were there for over a year, on and off,
mm-hmm.
and some of us were and some of us weren't. My camera assistant went through the whole thing without even a cold. I think I caught a cold and had a tummy upset at one point. But by and large, looking at it from a traveler's point of view, I think you can have a good time if you're careful and don't eat somewhere that doesn't look good. On the broader question of public health, I think it's a big issue. People are having to pay for medical treatment. I think it's very difficult for rural people to get to a doctor and to get to hospitals. I think they have big problems in terms of public health.
You didn't have to go to a hospital.
We filmed in hospitals, and I think if you're lucky enough to get to one, we filmed in orphanages and hospitals. I think it's pretty good, but I think a lot of people are denied the access to it.
All right, Matt, in wherever. Matt, you're on forum. Good morning.
Ah, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask if you have any thoughts on the way that the United States seems to want China to adopt first world environmental policies as a third world nation, yet also deprives China of one of the benefits of being a third world nation, which is being able to have cheap labor by doing import tariffs and preventing China from really being able to maximize that.
Want to try that?
I don't want to try that. No, that seems to be a question about America, not about China. I look. It's plain, isn't it, that something unfair seems to be going on. Okay, you don't need to be a great economist to know that something unfair is going on. We'd like our China to supply us with cheap stuff. We don't like the penalties. We wouldn't pay for the penalties and the price of that ourselves. So it looks like we've shunted away from us burdensome practices, dangerous processes in some cases. We know that there are firms that make leather bags where the processes are banned in Italy, say, where the handbags may be sold under Italian names.
Mm-hmm.
But those tanneries operate in China, and the outflow from those factories poisons the water and kills people. Those are very, very, very terrible connections between us and them. And there is clearly something extremely unfortunate going on. But how do you put a brake on Western demand for cheap goods? And if China says, no, we don't want to have this, it's bad for us, we don't want it, then won't somebody else, probably in Asia or somewhere else in Africa, start supplying those services? And won't that cycle of exploitation just shift?
And maybe not even in Asia. Interesting question. No big answer. Jason in Berkeley. Hi, you're on forum.
All right. Thank you. I'm actually kind of referring back to something you were talking about near the beginning of the program when you were talking about how the government sort of has control over the way that the people think, or you were talking a little bit about I was actually surprised, I guess, to say that you were saying how much you thought people were free to disagree with the government because my experience is fairly different. I work at Berkeley, and I work with a number of Asian students, a number of Chinese and Taiwanese students, and always, I can never believe how much they still agree very much with the government, even though they're in the United States. They pretty much come from an upper crust Chinese education, but they still largely agree with the policies of the government. I'm curious what your take is on that.
Very quickly, let me correct something. If I gave a wrong impression, I do not believe that that China is speaking out bravely at every level. What I sensed was that some individuals felt strongly enough and had a clear enough vision of what they thought ought to be done that they did not feel inhibited to talk out. I also share your view that there are very many people who seem to toe the line when they talk, particularly to foreigners. They want China to show a good face. They don't want us airing, problems, washing dirty linen in public or whatever you want to call it. The things that I found were hopeful were not that I thought that the people were not under a cloud of control, which I think in many ways and in many places they are, but that there seem to be some hopeful pioneers, some sort of ice-breaking people who are carving some sort of a way at some considerable, in cases, risk to themselves in order to try and better society. And The other thing I'd say to you is, why don't you pitch up tonight if there's any room at UC Berkeley and look at the film, which we're looking at free speech and justice and touching exactly on the things that you're raising.
Okay. We're talking to Jonathan Lewis, China from the Inside, a four-part documentary series on KQED, Wednesday this week at 9 and 10 and Wednesday next week at 9 and 10. He's also going to be at UC Berkeley at 7 o'clock tonight at the Pacific Film Archive. One question that's, we don't have enough time for you to really answer it, I don't think. Were there places you really didn't get into? Were there things you thought you didn't find out that you wanted to find out?
Yeah, there were places. And in, I mean, very quick example. I mean, there were some places that I didn't get into. Like I wanted to watch one of the very brave people I'm referring to fighting an environmental court case in a law court. We got into law courts, but mostly the cases that we were looking at were very bland. There were things I didn't get into, but that just means that there's more work to be done, whether by me or maybe by other people, and it shows that. As the last speaker suggested, that things cannot be looked at rosily. You know, you come away from a big series like this, you don't want to come away with a false impression.
Was there some frustration involved?
There were frustrations and there were raised voices and there were arguments. And I'll tell you something interesting. I believe that we got what we got because we were helped by people whom sometimes we never saw. So people told us no, but other people told us yes. One guy said to me one day, a minder, he said, you know, I'm not going to be with you tomorrow. I said, really? He said, yeah, funny that. He said, yeah, I'm going off to do something else. See you then. And we got great stuff that next day.
In other words, he knew. He was giving you the word
that
you could shoot something you weren't supposed to shoot.
Now, don't let one little flower tell us that it's spring is coming. But this is must be hopeful for people to realize that this is not monolithic. And there are people in that country who want to make things better.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan Lewis, who's the writer, narrator, producer, and director of China from the Inside. This Wednesday and next Wednesday, 9 and 10 o'clock on KQED and other stations around the country, and tonight at UC Berkeley at the Pacific Film Archive. It's an interesting documentary, and you'll learn a little bit about China you didn't know. You've been listening to Forum from KQED FM. I'm Spencer Michaels.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.